August, 80 years ago, it was 1945 and a significant month in the course of World War II. And we're fortunate this morning to have our renowned author, TV presenter, and Australia's own war historian, Matt McLaughlin. Matt, once again, thank you for joining us and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mick.
Matt, August 1945 saw the atomic bombings of Japan and their subsequent surrender. Are you able to take us through what the lead up was to the bombings?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a busy time during the Second World War. There was a lot going on. So if we cast our mind back to May 1945, the Germans had surrendered and the war in Europe had come to an end at that time, but the Japanese were still fighting on in the Pacific, and it was a total lost cause for the Japanese. They had no chance of winning. Ever since 1943, they'd been slowly pushed back towards Japan, and now the Allies, the Americans in particular, were right on their doorstep. So we'd seen the battles of Iwo Jima at the start of 1945, and then the huge battle to capture the Japanese island of Okinawa, which took place earlier in 1945 as well, in April 1945. So the Americans were poised to invade the islands of Japan. That was the next step in the battle. The southern island of Kyushu was where the Americans were going to launch their next invasion, which was the first proper Japanese home island. So this was the invasion of Japan. And it was expected that that would begin in late 1945 and continue well into 1946. But of course, the atomic bombings in August ended all that. The atomic bombs were a huge secret. No one knew that they had them. Only the upper echelons of Americans' leadership knew that they had the atomic bombs. And they dropped two atomic bombs in August 1945, which forced the Japanese to admit defeat and surrender. So it was actually quite a surprisingly quick end to the war that no one had anticipated.
I remember reading somewhere that Japan was actually warned that there would be catastrophic action taken if they didn't surrender. Was that something that came out later on in the war, or how did that come about?
No, that's 100% correct, Mick. And what we should say is there's a lot of revisionist history has happened about the atomic bombings in the decades since 1945. So perhaps we can look at some of that. But that's quite correct. The Potsdam Declaration that came out in July 1945 warned. It gave the Japanese a list of requirements to surrender, for unconditional surrender. But it also said that if they didn't surrender, they would suffer complete annihilation. So it was a warning to the Japanese that they didn't quite heed, that the Americans were suggesting that they had weapons that they could employ against the Japanese, which turned out to be the atomic bombs. So it wasn't an implicit warning, but they were telling the Japanese that they faced annihilation if they didn't agree to surrender ASAP.
Yeah, which was a big thing. And at that time, Harry Truman was the US president, but he would have had a lot of complexities to go through and consider before he made the decision on using the atomic bombs. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, it's a fascinating chapter of the story and to understand exactly Truman's motivations. So Truman never doubted that they had to use the atomic bombs against Japan. And one of the great myths of this story is the suggestion that's been made in post-war years that the Japanese were about to surrender. There's a whole heap of theories that say why the Americans shouldn't have used the atomic bomb. And one of them is that the Japanese knew the war was over, they were ready to surrender, and so the Americans just dropped the bomb anyway, just as some sort of evil weapons test or something like that. We know that is completely untrue. And the reason we know that is that we had broken the Japanese codes so we could understand what they were communicating within their highest diplomatic circles. And the Japanese had no intention of surrendering in August 1945. In fact, it was the opposite. They had guessed where the Allies were going to land on Kyushu, and they had determined that they would turn that into the biggest battle of the war. So they had thousands of aircraft, thousands of kamikaze suicide aircraft. They had told every citizen of that island to prepare to give their lives for the emperor. And the slogan they were using is 100 million deaths for the emperor. That was what they'd said to the Japanese people. So we knew that the Japanese had absolutely no intention of surrendering and that the atomic bombs were the only way to end the war. And that fact is even proven by the fact that when we dropped the first atomic bomb on the Japanese, they still didn't want to surrender. It wasn't until the second bomb was dropped that they realized that they were facing complete destruction and came to the negotiating table. So anyone that says to you the Japanese were intending to surrender anyway and the bombs didn't have to be dropped doesn't know what they're talking about, basically.
And it is, and I guess we do have to consider, there was a great cost to those atomic bombs in the case of humanity, I suppose. How did it go post-bomb for Japan with dealing with the amount of loss?
It was a lot of people were killed by the atomic bombs, and let's not shy away from that fact. So between 150,000 and 250,000 people, most of them civilians, were killed in the atomic bombings, and that's obviously that's absolutely horrific, and we should never forget how horrific that statistic is. But the other thing we should remember as well is that the war was costing millions of lives as it continued. Another, I don't like to make it a game of statistics, but just something else to consider is that it's estimated that up to 400,000 civilians in Asia were dying every month under Japanese occupation, because the Japanese were such brutal occupiers that they were killing between 200,000 and 400,000 civilians in Asia every month that the war continued. And so when you look at it through that perspective, you think, well, ending the war at any cost was really essential. This war had to end. It had already cost up to 50 million lives, and it just absolutely had to end, which is why the Americans decided to use the atomic bombs. But it was shocking. This was the only time in history that atomic weapons had been used in warfare, and it was devastating for the people of Japan. It was devastating for the people, but not their leaders so much, because, as I said, their leaders were determined to fight on even after the bombings. They said, we still got to continue fighting. And so you have this strange situation where the people were suffering, and they were suffering under conventional bombing. They were suffering starvation under a blockade of Japan. So the people of Japan were really suffering, but their leaders insisted on carrying on the fight. So it really was one of the most cold-hearted decisions in history, was Japanese leadership refusing to surrender when they knew the war was over.
Yeah, there were certainly no winners there. And how did Australia react to the news that Japan had surrendered at that time?
It was incredibly exciting for the people of Australia, as it was around the world, because it was so unexpected. No one knew the atomic bombs were going to be dropped. And in fact, Australian troops were preparing to participate in the invasion of Japan. So it was expected that Australians would join the Americans and other allies in invading Japan. So we were gearing up for huge losses. We were expecting the casualties would be very high. And more importantly, we were expecting the war would carry on well into 1946. So the dropping of the atomic bombs, which effectively shortened the war by a year or more, came as a great shock, but also a great relief to the people of Australia. And there were huge celebrations in Australia to celebrate that the war was finally over. So we'd seen celebrations in May to commemorate the German surrender, but it was a huge party in August when the Japanese surrendered.
And look, how do you think the events of the atomic bombings have shaped the world that we live in today?
It's a great question, Mick. It obviously had a huge effect on the world. So I think the Second World War in general led to a huge change in the way we look at the world, because there was a determination for it never to happen again. And we should thank the Americans a lot in this as well, because the Americans were responsible in a large part for the rebuilding of the world after the Second World War, and things like the formation of the United Nations. And even though that certainly hasn't worked perfectly, it's been a great step forward in terms of world peace. The atomic bombings specifically led directly to the Cold War, where both America and Russia had nuclear weapons and seemed prepared to use them, particularly during the 1960s, but in a sort of a perverse way, the use of atomic weapons has led to lasting peace, because every nation now knew that the next war, the next world war, would involve atomic weapons, and that there was a risk of the entire planet being destroyed. And so I think that fear of destruction has actually in many ways preserved peace. And we came out of the 20th century, which was the most violent century in human history. More people died in the 20th century than any other time in human history, into what has been a relatively peaceful 21st century. And so the second half of the 20th century and so far the first quarter of the 21st century have been relatively peaceful compared to what we saw in the 20th century. So my hope is that the deterrent that exists because of the fear of nuclear weapons will mean that a large war like that will never happen again.
Let's hope so. And Matt, look, I know you take Australians on battlefield tours throughout the world, and obviously Japan is a bit different because there was an atomic bombing. But if you were to visit Hiroshima or Nagasaki, is there still images or reminders of the bombings?
Yeah, there absolutely is. In Hiroshima in particular, there's some very good museums that tell the story, and one of the buildings that was destroyed is still preserved in Hiroshima. So there are stories that there are places that you can absolutely learn the story of the atomic bombings, and the same in Nagasaki. And it's fascinating that people do want to go to these places to learn about it firsthand. And World War II in particular is becoming very popular for Australians to go overseas and visit these sites, so much so that through my tour company, we're now doing river cruises in Europe that visit battlefield sites throughout the heart of Europe. So Australians are very keen to travel to these destinations overseas and to walk that ground and to learn more about this really important history. So I think we're very lucky in Australia that we can combine two of our great passions, which is learning more about military history, but also traveling the world.
Well, I guess that brings me to Pearl Harbor, because, you know, they really got brought into the world with the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 42. So if you go to Hawaii, are there signs of the war or tours there that, you know, people are able to take or learn more about?
Oh, absolutely. I would say to anyone that goes to Hawaii, you absolutely have to go to Pearl Harbor, because it's extraordinary how it tells that story. And again, we have to give credit to the Americans. I think they do this better than anyone in terms of preserving a historic site and telling the story. And Pearl Harbor is a very popular site for people to visit. And you can do a boat cruise out along Battleship Row and see the wrecks of the ships that are still there under the water, and an excellent museum. And there's a submarine there. You could easily spend an entire day at Pearl Harbor studying World War II history and the history of the war in the Pacific. So anyone that goes to Hawaii absolutely has to include Pearl Harbor on their list of things to see.
And of course, we have our own National War Memorial in Canberra. And if someone would like to see or hear more about the war in the Pacific, what can our war memorial provide them?
Well, there's a lot of good displays on World War II in the War Memorial, and it's actually getting better, bigger and better, because they're doing some pretty massive expansions to everything that's going on there. But they've always done a pretty good job of telling the World War II story, and from what I understand, it's going to be even better in the new galleries. So it is really a place where you can go to learn our full military history from pre-colonial times right up to the modern conflicts. So again, as a must-see visit when people in Canberra, the War Memorial is an institution that shouldn't be missed.
No, it is, and I know it's still going under significant renovations, and I think it was planned for about 2027. Are they still on target to have it all done by about 2027?
Yeah, I think they are. I haven't been very particularly heavily involved in what they're doing there, but I've been kept updated by my friends at the memorial, and it seems to be going very well. So I think I saw that G for George has been moved back in, the big Lancaster bomber. So I think by next year, by 2026, most of it will be complete, and there'll be some wonderful new galleries to see. So they've spent an awful lot of money and made some incredible changes to the War Memorial, which, to be honest, I think have been controversial, and some of them I have raised questions about as well. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of money they've invested to make it an absolutely world-leading institution, and I think people will see that when they go down there.
Oh, look, and that's fabulous. I always ask you, because you're always writing books and taking tours, is there a new book on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a book now about a village in France called Mont-Brehan, and this was actually Australia's last battle of the First World War. And so this was in October 1918. Australia captured this village from the Germans, and it was a fairly small battle, pretty insignificant, except we lost about 400 men in that battle, and a large proportion of them were Gallipoli veterans. So imagine what it means for blokes to have served from Gallipoli all the way through the Western Front, and then to be killed on the last day of fighting, which was the 5th of October. Over 1918. So it's a very moving story. So I'm working on that book now, which will be out next year.
Oh, well, I look forward to reading that, and we'll have you back on the program to discuss it. But again, it's been a pleasure speaking with you on our program here this morning, Matt. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mick.